Exodus 20, verse 17, the 10th of the 10 commandments God gave to Moses, reads like this. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, his male or female servants, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Hi, my name is Amy, and I am really good at breaking this commandment. I haven't murdered anyone, and I haven't committed adultery, but I am a pretty covetous person. In fact, if you live in middle America, if you own a television, if you've seen a billboard, if you've listened to a commercial on the radio, if you engage in social media, I bet you are almost as good as me at coveting. Maybe even better. To covet is to wish for, to want, to desire something so eagerly, so strongly, that we lose sight of people in the process. We lose the regard for others. The Hebrew word here is kamad, which is translated covet, lust, or strongly desire. So when I look at this, it feels kind of impossible. Right? We're built to desire things, to want to be in community, to want to engage with others. Is it wrong to desire? Is it wrong to want? How am I not supposed to want? How many of you grew up with the Toys R Us or maybe the Sears Christmas catalog? Do you remember that? The Toys R Us one, I swear, was the size of a phone book. And I would get that and I would go through it with my sister with a magic marker, circling all the things that we were surely not getting for Christmas. In this day and age, I thought we were past that, but it turns out Target still makes a Christmas toy catalog, and my mother showed up with it at my house and handed it to my four-year-old, who promptly got a crayon out to circle all of the things. And when I scroll social media on my phone, when I go through my Instagram feed, I want it all. The ads are obviously curated for my interests. But the highlight reels posted by friends or friends of friends of their gorgeous kitchens or their home makeovers or their smiling husbands and perfectly posed children, I want that. I don't see any clutter. I don't see any crumbs or any arguing happening in their photos. And sometimes I feel like that spoiled child from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Veruca. Do you remember her? She was the one that goes after the golden goose. And she sings, I want the world. I want the whole world. I want to lock it all up in my pocket. It's my bar of chocolate. Give it to me now. Have you ever felt like that? So are we allowed to want things? What about wanting more serious things like goals? So much of the self-help industry is centered on the idea of goals, long-term goals, short-term goals, career goals, weight loss goals, education goals, financial goals. Is it wrong to want those? Is it wrong to want more education? Is it wrong to want to be debt-free or at least have a little bit less debt? Is it wrong to want a raise at work? Is all wanting wrong? Let's reread this passage again, but from a different translation. This is the message. No lusting after your neighbor's house or wife or servant or maid or ox or donkey. Don't set your heart on anything that is your neighbor's. Don't set your heart on anything that is your neighbor's. That's the point. It's the desire for what someone else has, specifically for what your neighbor, someone in your circle, your community, your group of friends, your family, what they have. So I think there's two core issues here. First, coveting ultimately damages your community. Even if no one knows what's going on in your head or your heart, it still fractures your relationships. Here's a really obvious example. Let's say that you are coveting your neighbor's spouse, your literal next door neighbor's spouse. You desire them. You want them. That's going to consume your thoughts. You'll be unable to offer your true self in community with that person, with their spouse, with your own spouse if you're married. You'll be unable to serve your neighbor, serve their spouse, serve your spouse in a way that reflects Jesus. And you'll be unable to be authentically who God created you to be because you are so consumed with that specific greed. And you may never act on it. You may never say a word to anyone. No one may know, but you will know. And there's never a time that it won't come up in your thought life. That greed, that covetousness, that lust will create fault lines in your relationships with all of those people. The second issue is that our coveting is an indicator of our discontent. It's a heart issue, really. Another fracturing of a relationship, but this time, not between us and our community, but between us and God. When we covet, we are expressing distrust in God. We don't trust God to give us what we need. Let me be clear. I think that there is a healthy discontent and a sinful discontent. Healthy discontent comes when God is calling us to something new or something different or something healthier, and we know that we need to make changes in our life to get there. You'll know the difference when you're walking it out. Healthy discontent actually requires us to trust God more as we seek what is next. And healthy discontent leads to growth. Sinful discontent, on the other hand, expresses itself in brokenness. Whereas healthy discontent leads us to look up and look out, sinful discontent sends our eyes down, keeps our eyes pointed at the ground, staring at what surrounds us. And sinful discontent is what leads us to coveting, living in a fantasy world, desiring what others have so deeply that we begin to break down the relationships with those closest to us, including with God. So I want to share a story with you about some discontent in my life. 2 years ago, almost to the day, I left my job, my career really, to move across the state with my husband and my then 3-year-old daughter. I didn't want to move at all, and I was very clear about that. It was a promotion for my husband and an incredible opportunity for him, but it meant giving up our community, our close family, our circle of friends, our support, and my career. We had a second baby due in just a couple of months, and rather than seek out a ministry position and quickly have to go on maternity leave and then seek out incredibly expensive childcare, we made the decision that I would become a stay-at-home mom, which, no offense to stay-at-home moms, I was raised by one. It was never part of my plan. So I went from being an on-the-go, out-and-about, extroverted pastor to youth and children and families to a pregnant, tired, stay-at-home mom in a brand new town. And then literally the next week after we moved in, my dad died suddenly. And 2 weeks after that, my maternal grandmother passed away in the middle of the night. And so we became consumed, or I guess I became consumed with grief. It felt like my extended family was shattered. I was setting up a nursery and planning a funeral and Googling directions to the grocery store. Ultimately, we got through that season, even if it meant having a funeral and a 4-year-old birthday party on the same weekend. Our second daughter was born, and we started to make our way. And then Gosh, I don't know about you guys in Arizona, but in Ohio, we had this little thing. They called it a pandemic. Did you have that? Yeah. And everyone's lives were completely upended. Okay. So my husband pivoted to working from home. I became a homeschool preschool teacher. Not my best career path. And our baby grew into a toddler who barely saw another adult other than her own parents. We were lucky. We were healthy. And just as the vaccines rolled out, we found out we were pregnant with baby number three. Baby number three, whose arrival was not, let's say, anticipated. Baby number three to the mother who had given away half of her baby gear and all of her maternity clothes. I gotta tell you, those type of pregnancy announcements are not quite as thrilling as the earlier ones. And to be honest, all I could think was, I don't want this. I don't want this. For months, actually, I had been thinking, I don't want this. I don't want this move. I don't want this loss. I don't want this grief. I don't want these postpartum hormones. I don't want this sassy four-year-old attitude. I don't want this pandemic. Because what? A pandemic? Yeah. I don't want to be stuck at home. I don't want to be doing educational activities with a four-year-old. I don't want to be cleaning up the kitchen again. I don't want this messy living room. And ultimately, I don't want to be pregnant. I know how that sounds. It took us a very long time to get pregnant with our first. And we experienced a miscarriage between our two births. I know what it is to want a baby so much that you would give anything. I know what it is to grit your teeth and smile when a friend announces their pregnancy over lunch or at church. I know that pain. I remember throwing my phone across the kitchen after finding out a friend was pregnant while I was still miscarrying. So hear me when I say, I get it. I don't take it lightly. And I know what it is to be on both sides of this and to know both sides are hard. I didn't want any of my life at that point. It was February and I wanted someone else's life. I was done. My faith had been in a deconstruction mode for what felt like years. I was asked to come up with a devotion for our church's Lent series, and I didn't think I had anything encouraging to share. I was scrolling social media obsessively on my phone, envying everyone. This girl's hair, that girl's family, that guy's career, envying their lifestyles, envying the fact that when the vaccines rolled out and life would reopen, they could all resume life as normal and I would be home in my own sort of lockdown with a newborn and a toddler and a preschooler. My marriage felt rocky. My parenting was less than desirable. Nobody was writing a book about me and my parenting at that point. To say I was discontent was an understatement. All I could see was the mess around me. So we are a family of routine. No matter what's going on, we stick to our routine. And so every night, my husband was in charge of putting our oldest to bed, and I put the baby to bed. She would get a snack and a sippy cup of milk, a story, and then we would sing and rock in the rocking chair. Moms, I don't know about you. Dads, I don't know about you, but I don't sing the same songs to both of my girls. I had multiple songs to sing to my first. And when my second was born, I just couldn't sing those same songs to her. And so I reached back into the recesses of my memory and came to songs that we used to sing at church camp when I was a kid. Songs with such simple lyrics that you didn't need songbooks. And so the song I sing to my youngest is this. It's so simple, and it's just, God is so good. God is so good. God is so good. He's so good to me. I Googled this recently. Apparently there are other verses, but this is all I've ever remembered. And it felt ironic to me singing this affirmation of God's goodness when I was so discontent, so desperate for something else. One night, I'm not sure if I was putting the baby down for the first time or the third time, I was rocking her and I was singing, and I realized that I had changed the lyrics subconsciously. That instead of singing, God is so good, God is so good, God is so good to me, I was singing, God is still good, God is still good, God is still good, He's still good to me. And the realization startled me, and I choked up as I laid my Josie girl in her crib to sleep. My Josie, whose name means God will add. Kamad, to covet, is a path that leads to destruction. In the Old Testament, writers recorded instructions from God, from Yahweh, to the nation of Israel not to covet the silver or gold of the Canaanite idols because it was a false religion. And this is what God says. The images of their gods you're to burn in the fire. Don't covet the silver and gold on them. Don't take it for yourselves, or you will be ensnared by it, for it is detestable to the Lord your God. Don't bring a detestable thing into your house, or you, like it, will be set apart for destruction. Utterly abhor and detest it, for it is set apart for destruction. Deuteronomy 7, 25 and 26. So friends, when we make room in our life for sinful discontent, when we desire that which is not ours, that which objectifies others or tears them down, when we can't find any goodness in God, we are bringing destruction into our homes, into our hearts, and it's only a matter of time before that comes out. Because here's the thing, God is not keeping good things from you. Let me say that again. God is not keeping good things from you. If God is love, would it not make sense that God would want to give you good things? Yes, we live in a broken world. And yes, suffering of all kinds is inevitable. And I will stand up and preach that to the end of my days, having walked the road that I've walked. But our God is a God of blessing and a God of redemption and a God of restoration. When we are jealous and we desire the blessings that God has given to someone else, we both fail to see the blessings in our own lives and fail to see the true nature of the God who has blessed us. When we desire the blessings of God in someone else's life, we fail to see the blessings of our own lives and the true nature of the giver of those blessings, of our God. We are headed down a path of destruction in our community and in our communion. So how do we avoid that path? Honestly, I think we need a reality check from time to time. We need to actively and honestly assess our mindset, our thought life, asking the Spirit to highlight where it is that we are discontent, where it is that we are coveting, where it is that we are fracturing our relationships. And then, while I both kind of love and hate that this has become a trend. We need to practice gratitude. We do. We need to practice gratitude. Contentment and peace are found through gratitude, through the process of identifying every gift as a blessing, every gift as a gift from God in our lives. And when we can recognize something as a blessing in our lives, no matter how unusual or unexpected, it's hard to wish for something different. Words have power. Names have power. I think it's incredibly significant that in the creation account, God doesn't just create night and day. God names night and day. God doesn't just create the sky, the seas, the land. God names the sky, the seas, the land, and so on. If you're a parent, you know the creativity, the joy, the intentionality that comes, and the pressure that comes in naming a child. And so when we name something in our life as a gift, as a blessing, as something for which we are grateful, then it brings much more contentment and much more peace into our lives. When we can name the gifts of God as good, then we can name God as good, which restores and strengthens our relationship with God. When we can name the gifts of God in our own life, then our gratitude bursts forth into contentment, and we literally don't have space to desire something that is not our own. My babies, both born and unborn, are gifts, no matter how surprising their arrival. My husband, my community, my friends are gifts. And even my struggles have become gifts as I have found growth and hidden blessings in them. The 10th commandment, do not covet, isn't just a rule. Actually, it's an invitation. It's an invitation into a practice of gratitude that leads to contentment. And that life of contentment, that life of peace, that's the kingdom, friends. That's the kingdom. That's the heaven on earth stuff that Jesus talks about. So may you take a clear and spirit-filled look at your own life. May you see both your healthy and your sinful discontent for what it is. May you see the relationships that have been fractured by your greed. And may you repent. May you begin the process of renaming that which in your life really is a gift, and thus rename the giver as good. Because friends, God is still good. God is still good. God is still good. God is still good to you. Amen.